here at Toyota. Kurt graduated in 1961 from Haverford College. Other famous people you may know from Haverford College are Joe Taylor, the discoverer of quasars, and Stefan Alexander, the famous he got his PhD from Princeton University in 64 and has been a Princeton on and off ever since. He is a McDonnell Distinguished University Professor of Physics at Princeton since 95. And he has been a fellow of the Interurban Societies. And he got the Sakurai Prize for Detective Particle Physics from the American Institute of Society in 2000. And the director of the Abu Salam Institute in 2004. He has been a member of German and several external advisory committees for various institutes and departments. He has been chairman of member of several advisory committees to the U.S. government. And today we will tell us about cellular biology and theoretical physics. I should mention that Kurt was the chairman of the steering committee for the genomics institute at Princeton. And this is where it's all comes from.
Yeah, not chairman. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a subject on which I am not an expert. So, I hope you're not an expert. So this is presumably a physics addicts audience. So I'll assume that your knowledge of things biological is relatively limited, but not zero. And that can probably provide me.
I think we're
okay. It's lighting up. All right. Get the battery going. That's it. Okay, so what I've done most in science has to do with particle physics and spherical spaces. So in the last 5 or 6 years, I've found myself being more and more fascinated with biology and trying to do a little bit of it myself, and I guess maybe I got involved because I was the department chair thinking about the physics department. My physics department was going. Got involved in joint ventures with the biologists on the Princeton University campus. Sort of the stick that I was wielding was biology has become sufficiently mature that the time has come for much more mathematical and theoretical approach to understand something that's more like what we're familiar with in physics. I have not reached a point where I think I understand exactly what those words mean for biology, but I have been gathering myself, picking up the odd pebble from the seashore, and I'll try to tell you something about that today. So the title of the talk is Cellular Biology and Theoretical Physics, and basically the question is, what can theoretical physics and or a theoretical physicist do that has relevance to the real problems of biology? And let's see. Okay, so I gave Ted an abstract, and I won't bother you by reading it, because you may well have seen it already. So this question is sort of timely, that is to say, is there something for theoretical physics or in general to say that's important to biology? And that is because, well, first of all, biology as it's practiced today looks more and more like physics. There are truly quantitative experiments, there are large volumes of data, there's sophisticated data analysis. People are beginning to get serious about making models of systems. The attitude you bring from physics is that models and data analysis have to be guided by some theoretical structure, otherwise you don't know what you're doing. And if you have a qualitatively striking phenomenon, it probably means that there's some underlying mathematical structure associated with them. Also, the importance of physics and biology is not just methodological, Cells often operate in a regime where physical constraints are important. A few words to say about that. So there are places where you really have to think like a good statistical mechanic in order to understand what's happening and why. Probably the most important thing is the genomic revolution. So the fact that it's now possible to sequence whole organisms and in some not completely precise way, but in some fairly global way, see what a cell is doing under different conditions, so-called expression profile, the ability to say, okay, under these conditions, temperature, nutrition, and whatnot, this particular animal has the following relative levels of expression of every last gene in its carcinoma. You can know this kind of thing. So this has brought these issues into sharper focus, and I think we need much more than what's called bioinformatics to extract meaning from the massive data that we produce. In other words, it's not just a problem of computer science and data analysis. You really need to understand what the data is trying to tell. So theoretical physics at least provides a reservoir of people and ideas, which are pretty well suited, I think, to taking up the challenge of biology. So to make this a bit more concrete, I'm going to talk about a few cases where sophisticated theoretical approaches are being used to address some problems in cellular biology. Now, on the next slide, which I may pass over, I just wanted to say something about the fact that this is not entirely new. I mean, physicists have had a big impact on biology at a number of stages. And actually, neurobiology, and everybody's familiar with Schrödinger's way of life, with Delbruck, the early stages of the development of molecular biology. What you may not know is that in neuroscience, over the last decade and a half or so, things have happened which have paralleled very much what I was just saying. That is to say, it's been possible to ask questions and collect data which are on such magnitude, such so comprehensive and so so many bits of information that analyzing them in qualitative fashion doesn't really do the job. You really need to bring much, much deeper ideas. You need to bring real ideas in the sense of physics into play to understand these things. There, I think there's a success story there. It's kind of existence proof that ideas from something like theoretical physics have been important in a significant area of biology in the not-so-distant past. I think it would take me too far afield to go very far with this, so I'll just leave it at that for the moment. So I'd like to talk about some illustrative examples from current work on problems in cell biology. I mean, biology is unfortunately or fortunately a really vast thing. You can talk about cells. You can talk about organisms that are unicellular. You can talk about viruses. Sure, you can't talk about viruses in the absence of cells. You can talk about metazoans, things that are collections of cells that do things together. You can talk about populations. You can talk about evolution. There's so many different things that one calls biology. I'll focus almost exclusively on cellular biology. That is to say, how do you understand what goes on in a single cell organism? That's as close as you get. Well, I don't know, that's sort of a carbon atom, maybe it's the uranium atom. The hydrogen atom is probably a virus. Okay? But the unfortunate thing is that a virus doesn't do anything useful unless it has a cell to hijack. So you sort of are stuck. You really do have to understand what happens with a cell. So it's unfortunately not as simple as, to use the physics analogy, a hydrogen atom, but it's probably as simple as we're going to get. So we just have to bite the bullet and try to say something about that. So I will probably not talk about all of these things. I will go as far as I can. So let me talk. I'll talk about optimization principles for identifying the targets of transcription factors, which are proteins which govern how genes get expressed and knocked off. And then a way of using evolution. This is sort of the subtopic of the first. A way of using I pointed at the screen, that's what I did. I pointed this one. Evolutionary comparisons as a way of learning something about this whole issue. So evolution really is the most amazing thing to me in biology. And it's interesting to see how the genomic revolution is making it possible to use evolutionary arguments to learn really quite precise things. Then there's this issue that I raised earlier. Noise, small numbers, and stochastic aspects of gene expression dynamics. There's stuff in there that quantum field theorists And finally, coordinate-independent approaches to finding groups of totally related genes. So in general relativists would like that. Something which turns out to be important. Okay, so let me teach you stuff that I have no doubt that many of you know already. So I'll do it quickly. A bit of an overview of gene expression. So the term expression simply means, you know, in your cell there's a molecule of DNA. It has the code for all the proteins that you're ever going to get to use. And not all of them are being made at any given moment. And so the expression of the gene is simply making the corresponding protein. It goes through two steps. The first step is to turn the sequence of ACTs and genes that are in the code, that code for the protein, to turn them into something called messenger RNA, which then floats out of the cell, and the messenger RNA then encounters something called the ribosome, which is a bizarre assemblage of proteins and RNA that does an amazing job. It takes that linear sequence of RNA and turns it into a linear sequence of amino acids by some complex process. And that's a protein. The protein folds, goes and does whatever the protein, whatever its protein job is. Now the point I want to focus on is that, so this linear structure here is meant to be some bit of DNA. The blue part, which really should go on for several blocks, is meant to be the sequence of bases that actually code for a protein. Code in the sense that triples of ACTs and Gs get translated to one of the 20 amino acids. So in the DNA, there are contiguous regions which code for a protein. And then before that coding region, there is a non-coding region. What is the non-coding region for? Well, it contains little signals which tell the apparatus, and in particular, the thing called RNA polymerase, where to sit down on the DNA and start doing their job in the message. Okay? And that's a sort of hidden away in that statement is something which is a rather complex set of things. There's this very specific guy, RNA polymerase, whose job is glom onto the DNA at a characteristic place before the gene is written, and then go through a dynamic process of chunking along the DNA and spitting out the next and the next and the next base in the message. That's what this thing in the here. Now, the RNA polymerase does its job by the rules of statistical mechanics. There's a particular sequence here to which this guy binds better than he binds to any other random sequence. And so if you don't do something, this RNA polymerase will just sit down and make the message for this protein all the time. So you have to be able to turn that on and off. And that, I said this next slide here, that regulating whether the polymerase can do its job is the duty of some proteins called transcription factors. So these are other things that recognize specific sequences in DNA. And so, for example, one of the things that can happen is that a transcription factor protein can be made, which will bind to this stretch of DNA here much more strongly than the polymerase does. And therefore, if that protein is being made, that transcription factor is present, it basically shuts off this whole process. Or it could go the other way around. A transcription factor could bind here and have the ability to basically enhance the binding affinity of the RNA polymerase. Because if it could have some protein-to-protein contribution to the overall energy of the system, which makes it favorable for the RNA polymerase to sit down. So depending on exactly where these things sit down, we either turn things off or turn them off. Okay, so we'll see where this is going shortly. So the basic mechanism is that these transcription factor proteins bind to short DNA sequences that are typically in those interstitial regions in DNA that don't actually code for any specific protein. It's there for either spacing or for the kind of thing I've just been talking about, providing control, providing the real estate on which various control proteins can run and length and do their job. You can have transcription factors that control the production of transcription factors that control the production of proteins. You can make all kinds of complicated circuits. And that's how. And if you have a nonlinear system, it's perfectly possible to have multiple basins of attraction, if you will, multiple fixed points, in hopes that they're stable. But it's putting together these complex circuits that makes it possible for cells to exist in different states. The cells of your body are either skin cells or muscle cells or nerve cells or whatever. They're all the same DNA. And they have made a choice as to what proteins are going to be expressed and what their function will be on the basis of the switching behavior of these complex circuits. And of course, the great, so to say, gold rush of this decade in the years, learning how, playing the stem cell game, to cause cells to change their decisions to what their fate is, nerve or muscle or whatever. But we will not get that far. Okay, there's a coding problem. The same transcription factor protein may have to turn off many different genes. And it may be, therefore, that it has to recognize. So you might think that's easy. All of the genes that are controlled by this one transcription factor, well, they'll all have the same little sequence upstream of them, and the transcription factor will bind to it, and that will be fine. That, in fact, is not the way it works. If you look at the sequences to which a particular transcription factor binds, you'll find that they're actually rather different. They have some vague statistical similarity, but they are by no means rigidly the same. So the question is, if you wanted to go, to the sites to which these things bind are statistically defined at best. What I'd like to talk about now is the general problem of how do you characterize the sequences to which transcription factor binds, and can you use that to start getting some notion of what is the connectivity of the control that the transcription factors belong to. There's an awful lot of genomic information available for your contemplation. And one of the interesting things one of the things which is different now as compared to a decade ago is that hundreds of organisms have their genomes completely sequenced. And so you can go to the web and you can see the actual sequence of, let's say, E. coli, because they're bacteria. And you can also see exactly how it's organized. That is to say, you can see which stretch corresponds to this gene, to which gene, what are the actual stretches between genes, cell sequence of them. You can learn of the genes that you've identified, what genes are they like in other organisms, and from that you can infer what their function must be. E. coli, just to give you a number, I say it has 3,400 genes, I think that's so somewhere in that general ballpark. One slightly alarming feature of going to look at this data is that you look at the list of genes that are coding for, proteins that are coding for, and typically they'll say, maltose metabolism, or transported loss, or something else. But some truly alarming fraction of things that are identified have as their notation, the functional notation, unknown. Okay, so a large fraction of what's there is not similar to anything else and has no known function. So we'll come back to that at the end.
Is this a good lesson?
Well, so for bacteria, I should say, yes, I mean, this is certainly the thing that has been explicitly studied experimentally in the lab to the greatest level of detail. Somewhere back in the midst of time, the biologists agreed that they'd all, 3 days a week, they'd all work on E. coli. And then Thursday and Friday, they could work on other organisms in life better. So there's an enormous mass. They agreed that this is the model now to know the most about. Bacteria have a neat feature, and that is that it's pretty easy to figure out where, which stretches of DNA must code for protein, which not. That's because there's some characteristic features. There's a characteristic start codon, which is fixed. That's where transcription starts. There's also, it's, you get pretty far by saying, if you start, let's say, here, is this triplet the start of my gene? Well, if it's an AUG, then, or ATG, yes, probably is, but maybe not. Maybe that's just a random triplet. It isn't really the right thing to start with. So you start marching down in triplets, triplet, 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 triplet. Some of the triplets don't code for anything. They're nonsense. So if you run into a nonsense codon after 5 or 6 times 3, or 20 times 3, you're pretty sure that that's not actually a protein, because they're never that short. Okay, so you look for open reading frames, as they call them, that are long. It turns out some kind of simple statistical analysis like that basically allows you to parse the genome of all the bacteria. This does not work for the higher animals because the genes are not transcribed, not turned into protein in a simple way. The message has bits of it sniffed out, and the stuff that's left behind is glued back together again, and there's a rather complicated cut and paste going on that you can't quite so easily establish from just looking at the genome itself. One thing that you pretty quickly become aware of is that these genomes are highly non-random. In zero approximation, you say, well, there are four base ACT and G, and roughly speaking, they're used with equal probability, and that's, of course, not entirely true. The things that live in the hot water, for example, are very heavily, they very heavily use just G and C, because those guys bind together with a somewhat stronger binding energy than A and T do, so they stick together better than extremes of temperature. But now, in zero approximation, you can say, it looks almost like a random sequence of four objects chosen at random with equal probability. Well, of course, there's the triplet codes, so you expect to see non-randomness there. But then if you go to even higher levels of analysis, you discover pretty early on that the genomic data is very powerful. And you need some intelligent statistical analysis to help you sort out where are not the genes, but where are the pieces of DNA that are part of the control map. That's the problem that I want to focus on. How do you figure out what the control map? So let me talk more specifically about two transcription factors that play a metabolic role in E. coli and often in some other bacteria as well. They simply give you a very well-studied, simple to understand set of elements to play with. So what I've got up here is a slightly more detailed look at a region of DNA that sits between the two genes. And in fact, this is the region of DNA, unfortunately, somehow the vagaries of poster, all the rest of that, the little letters here, completely illegible. But never mind that. What we have here is a sequence. All of these little dots are ACTs and Gs, and hardly matters at all. We have a longish stretch of DNA here, and starting here, we transcribe three genes whose function in life is to eat lactose. So when lactose is around, it's good food for bacteria. It wants to make these genes. Most of the time, it doesn't have lactose. It's not living in the mammal. It doesn't have lactose around. So it's not interested, and it does not want to make these genes. So there's something up here called LACI, or lac repressor, which is a protein which, when made, comes around and binds here, right here. When it binds right there, it interferes with the ability of this RNA polymerase guy to bind and do his, basically shuts off the transcription of the black scene and all the rest. Now, there's another transcription pattern called CRP, which has a different function. It is another, if you have the cell would much rather eat glucose than lactose, even if lactose is available, if glucose is available. So there's another signal that says there's no glucose around. So if there's no glucose around, it has the effect that this other protein, CRP, or sometimes it's called CAB, which is lying around in the cell, it's a monitor. Something that's associated with shortage of glucose appears, causes these two guys to bind together. When they bind together, they form a transcription factor that can bind to the DNA. And when they bind to the DNA, they do precisely what I said before. They enhance the binding of this thing that does the transcription to the DNA. So this is the RNA polymerase, and this is the transcription factor CAP, bound to its activator site, and it binds to a bit of the RNA polymerase, makes it more likely that that guy's going to do his job. So there's a fairly intimate interaction of, in this case, two different transcription factors. They both bind to different pieces of the DNA, and we're going to look next at the heart of the matter. So here are. Here's some information about the DNA sequences to which some of these guys belong. So let's start first of all with this so-called lac repressor, the guy that turns off the production of the proteins that are needed to metabolize lactose. Okay, people have their various molecular biology ways of doing this. You can find it by mixing together DNA and this the LACI protein, and then various biochemical magic, you can find, well, to what particular stretch of DNA is the LACI protein stuck. Okay? Basically, you let it bind where it wants to, then you covail it with the DNA, and you eat away all the DNA that sticks out on the ends, and then you unbind it. And you take the protein boundaries of the stretch of DNA out, and then you let the DNA come off, and you see it. So when you do that, you can find what are the, how long is the stretch of DNA to which this transcription factor binds to bind, and what is it? So here's an example. Here is this guy, black eye, and here is the sequence, the most important sequence to which it binds. That's the one that I alluded to on the previous slide, the one where it's sitting directly where the polymerase wants to bind in order to do its job, transcribing the gene. You know, here it is. Da, 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 da. By the way, what I write down here is the sequence that you would see if you read the other strand of the DNA in the reverse order. The reason why I do that is that this protein doesn't know which way it's binding. Okay, it's a perfectly symmetric protein. Therefore, you can't really say whether it's binding this sequence or the sequence you get by reading it in reverse order and changing a T into an A into a T, a C into a G, etc. So called reverse complementation. So there's this little ambiguity about which direction, which strand, double-stranded DNA is being read. So both are equally valid. It turns out there are a couple of other places where black bylaws combine as well, and that deals with slightly higher level assumptions in the regulation, and here are the sequences. So if you look at these sequences, you will say, how would I have recognized that these guys were the sequences, or how could I describe the sequence to which black bylaws combine? Well, if you let the eye roam over this, you will see that there's some places where something fairly deterministic seems to happen, like here. So right here, there's a G all the way down. And so there should be a corresponding place where it should be down here. C's all the way down. Now here it is, right here, okay? So that's a motif, as they say. It is to say, this guy really likes to have a G in position 5 from the beginning, and a C in position 5 from the end. And if you start looking, you can say, well, all right, one of the things that you might start looking for is as a function of position within the set, is the distribution of base pairs somehow non-random? Well, I think it's sort of obvious that it is. The degree of non-randomness varies from place to place. That is to say, here, it is truly non-random in the sense that it's rigorously a G, and here it's rigorously a C. But there are other places where, okay, it's happy if it's either a G or a C, but doesn't like an A or a D, stuff like that. So you can imagine converting this position-dependent statistics of four things into something slightly more complicated.
Why do energies of those two sequences are very similar but different?
Oh, that's because of which. This energy has a large, double or triple or quadruple quotation marks around. This is a very notional energy. It is somehow representative, meant to be representative of the quantum energy. These sequences, basically, by a method that I'll describe in a second, one can attempt to take this data, the observed distribution, and convert it into a problem, an underlying, so to say, Boltzmann probability of distribution, which is based on binding energy. The binding energy would have been exactly the same if the sequences that it were fed in initially were completely degenerate. But they're not. Therefore, the energy function that I extracted wasn't complete, it was nearly, but not quite. So this is not the physical energy. This is surrogatory. It's a computed number and not a measured number. People do go out and measure these things. Now, that is a very noble exercise. However, it is an exercise that takes a lot of time and a lot of work, and it's not something that you're going to do. In E. coli, there are 200, 300 transcription factors in different proteins that do different things, different sequences. In human, I would imagine there are thousands, a few thousand. You're never, going out and measuring is something you want to do a few times, but you really like to have some other way of getting at what the relative energy scales are. Just for reference, this other transcription factor that I mentioned, CRP, is a kind of general feel-good, feel-bad device, that is to say, it upregulates or downregulates a large number of genes simultaneously. And at the level of knowledge that existed around the year 2000, when you went to the databases, you would find something like 48 different sites regulating something like 40 different genes. That's probably a significant underestimate. But that just means that for this particular guy, there's really quite a large number of such sequences to which it is known to bind that are at your disposal. And this sort of reinforces the statistical point that I was making. And you can see even here, there are some places where it really likes to be mostly G, mostly C.
How statistically significant is this? Is there two signal places or C?
Well, You know, you see what the ends, the end for lack is six. So, you know, one of the stories is six.
Well, the fear, I mean, they're almost the same thing as
maybe. So something I'm about to say will be very surprising. Or I'm not sure about explaining it, but it's surprising. Okay, so so here's where you start playing the games that are slightly theoretical. Namely, if you're given that data, what could you do that would allow you to do further prospecting? That's to say, infer from what you know something about the sequence-dependent binding energy of these transcription factors, so that you could then go either to other organisms or to other parts of the genome and see whether there are other places, other targets that should be coming, but that you don't happen to know about. In other words, the things that they know, but they were looking under the lamppost, experimentally speaking. There can perfectly well be lots and lots of other genes that are regulated by a particular transcription factor that are not. So one way you can look at this, so to say, theoretically, you build a model for the binding energy, the dependence of binding energy on the sequence, and go looking at the genomes for, are there other sequences somewhere else that haven't been before that have predicted binding energies that are competitive to the transcription. Great. Okay, so very nice, and I think very useful approach to this was introduced in the mid-80s by a pair of biologists, Bergen and Hippel. And it's the idea is simplicity itself. It's so simple that quantum studies can't possibly be right. But I think the evidence is that it is, in fact, very close to that. Namely, I didn't show any pictures, but if you look at X-ray diffraction structure evidence for what happens when one of these proteins bonds onto the DNA, what if it's your DNA thing, and then there's this big floppy protein which is somehow stuck to it. And you can see that the protein has a little amino acid here that sticks into the, you know, sticks into the big groove of the DNA, sort of kind of contacts this base pair, and there's one next to it that sticks in there and contacts the next base pair. Sort of looks like one finger from the protein is attaching itself to one base pair of the DNA. On the other hand, these guys are all packed together. It's pretty hard to imagine that anything as simple as what I'm about to say could be true, and yet. So the hypothesis is, or the working model to play with, see where how far it gets you, is that the sequence-dependent binding energy is simply a sum of contributions, one from each base in the sequence. That is to say, you know, if you modify the sequence by changing the base pair here, position 7, well, you would modify the contribution of one of the terms in here, but you wouldn't modify anything else. It's a kind of one-point function. There are no, you're simply ignoring higher point correlations in the energy. No dependence on pairs of base pairs and pairs of location, much less triples and triples of locations. If you had to include such things, you would be subject to a rather unfortunate combinatorial explosion. You would never be able to get anywhere. But so this is just, so to say, intellectual necessity forces you to this one. And guarantee it's going to work. Now, so I come back to that later. All right, so basically, what's called a position weight matrix is just the collection of these things for each position. On the 22 or 3 days, depending on the transcription factor, you have four numbers which characterize the energy contribution if you have an A, C, T, or G at that position. And, you know, different transcription factors will have different such matrices describing them. And the elements of this position matrix could be estimated by in vitro biochemical experiments, but that's a lot of work. And our friends Bird and Hippel proposed an algorithm which had some kind of evolutionary thermodynamics justification for it. That in the end I don't find particularly convincing. But roughly speaking, they said, look at the statistics. You have a collection of sites that you know are real binding sites. Pick one of the positions. You see a distribution. one C, three Gs, two As, and one T. So that's a particular draw from a probability distribution. Well, and the probability distribution is alleged to be basically Boltzmann probability distribution that goes with that energy function. So use the draw as the estimate of the probabilities. What that leads you to basically is this. From the occurrence frequencies, let's say position I, how many times are your sample being paid? How many times you see it, et cetera. And basically take the log of that number. That's a rough and ready estimate of the appropriate value yield. Now there are two things that are done. Just for convenience, normalize it so that the strongest line, lowest energy in any one of your entries, in one of your positions, is zero. So that's where I take care of that, put a max in there. So everybody, all of these numbers are positive except for the one that has the biggest number of premises. It's given one or zero. And then this little fellow here, this one, what's called a pseudo account. Suppose that you have a rather thin sample and something that could happen doesn't happen at all. Well, suppose one of these guys is zero. Suppose for base A in this position I, it never occurred. So you put a zero. Well, that would then make the logarithm, the thing that you're taking is logarithm infinite. And so you would say that would never occur anywhere ever. And well, that's overstating what you call. You know that the probability of recurring, if you have seven chances to look, the probability of recurring must be less than 1/7. But to say that it's identically zero is going too far. So there's no guaranteed right way through this. So this is a pseudo, kind of pseudo, a fake count of one that takes into account the fact. If you see zero, but I'm not going to worry about that because there's the following game. But it seems to me that a much better attitude is the following. You have a model, that is to say, the energy is an additive sum of independent contributions. We have some data. And the model has parameters. Basically, you want to adjust the parameters of the model to give you the best parameters of data. Well, subject to what? Okay, so here's one. This is probably I won't want to go into this too deeply. The idea is something like this. Suppose that I imagine having a large vat with lots of DNA and lots of these transcription factors. And I imagine fishing out transcription factor bound in DNA. Do it 10 times. Well, I would like to achieve, I'd like to find the parameters in my model such that the fishing out gives me something that resembles as closely as possible to what I see, namely the sites to which the transcription factor binds biologically are this. And I may even know more. I may know that it binds 10 times more strongly to this site than to this site. I'd like that information to be reflected in what I get by choosing my parameters. So basically what I do is I say, let's calculate the probability using this standard thermodynamics tree for energy function. Stratified energy function has that energy. Let's use standard statistical mechanics. Let's ask, what's the probability in fishing out DNA to which transcription factor is bound, but finding N1 times the transcription factor bound to the first two sequences, N2 times the bound to the second two sequences, and so on. and insist that these N1s, N2s, and Ks be, proportionally in proportion to the relative binding probabilities that I have measured in my in vitro experiment. I know this is the probability of getting what I want. This is the probability, given the parameters, of getting something that matches the observations. And so I can do a variety. Basically, what I want to do is to adjust the parameters such that was probably the best. So, that turns out to be a very easy thing to do, mechanically, for an energy which is a beginning sum like this of four functions. And I can even solve the problem of finding the parameters that give you the best estimate under certain assumptions about the genome. So you notice here that I have to perform a partition sum of some kind, which sums over all the sequences which occur in the genome. And that means something about the genome in which the particle, which the transcription factor lives, is relevant to the whole enterprise. And if, for example, I make the assumption that the genome is just random sort of four bases with, let's say, equal probabilities, I can actually solve the optimization and solve the distribution factors quite straightforward. And that will give me exactly the formula I gave you in the previous slide. Okay, so this.
Sorry, just to understand.
Yeah. This, okay, is the outcome of carrying out an optimization of the energy function parameters on the assumption of this kind of energy function. Given I know it binds to the following sequences, and these guys live in these random genes.
Okay, just a, what's the difference between d hat and g, or are they supposed to be the same?
I guess they're the same.
Okay. Yeah. And the difference between rho and epsilon, are they supposed to be the same, or is there?
Well,
about affinities rho, and then you're summing over epsilon, which I thought would be affinities, so I'm just.
Okay, so the rows are here. So the rows, so nk is the number of times I've found the site sequence k. Nk over n was chosen to match the corresponding row. The epsilons are, okay, these are the individual site energy functions, the energy that chosen is that other one. Okay, so the point was there's an attitude towards finding out what this energy function is, which makes a certain amount of sense. That is to say, what you're doing is optimizing some statistically sensible thing with respect to the parameters in this energy function and the information that you have. And, in this case, assuming something which I said wasn't really true, the random genome. Random genome is just so I can do this analytically, but I don't have to do it analytically. Computers can do a lot of grunt work for you. You can actually do this for the new genome and ask whether anything different happens. That's useful. So we'll come to that in just a second. Okay, so let's just see how this all works in practice. So let's take the procedure I just described and apply it to that nice simple transcription factor by I that has these three binding sites that you can turn on and off in metabolism of lactose. So you got data. I converted it into that energy function by the mechanism I described. And you know, I'll get something that represents the energies of the different choices of bases at each of the positions in this 21 base pair sequence of DNA that binds. You know, so here are the numbers that come out of this. This time you'll notice you leave this column down and this column up. They're exactly the same. Now that's because I symmetrized, because I know that the real thing has to be symmetric in that part of the case, because of the symmetry of the molecule. And these guys are not as written. Strictly symmetric. So I'm taking what they give me and I simply my hand synthesize. That doesn't make a significant difference. It's probably a good thing to do. And the way you read the energy table is that you know your site is A, C, C, G. And in the first place you say A, that's word 0. In the second place you say C, that's word 25609. In the third place, we say C again. That's where we find 5.6. Something like that. And now, the proof for pudding is an eating. Now take this function and run it over the unit and ask yourself, okay, does this in fact tell you that the sites which biology has informed you are the place where it really wants to walk? Does your model in fact say that's what they really want to want? How does the rest of the genome compete? Okay, so this is not a cartoon. These are the actual data points. There's quite a little glitch up here if you're doing this matrix over the E. coli gene. So, you know, sort of kind of Gaussian with some kind of mean and some kind of variance. And way down here, you remember the numbers, is where the stuff we're interested in really belongs. So we have to look at this a little bit more carefully, but the point of the exercise is simply to say, this kind of approach is going to give you, you hope, a distribution of energies in all the sites that has a mean and a variance such that the places of, you know, near zero, where the actual strong binding sites are supposed to be, is a significant number of standard deviations away from the mean, so that with a few million base pairs, the number that fall down here is sufficiently damped by the Gaussian exponential, so that you really have a small number of competitors.
Is it theoretically legal that it should be able to
should be what?
It should be theoretically
for a random genome that would be for the breadth of the Gaussian quantum computer, the mean and the variance. Okay. The genome isn't quite random, so it isn't quite Gaussian. Okay. Side remark, okay, I will just lay it on the table. If you're really interested in the stuff which has disappeared below the resolution of this graph. Now, you're not totally uninterested in stuff on here, because it may very well be that the sites where the actual function of the structure factors found are better around here. On the other hand, it's got to get there. It has to find its way along the genome to the sites where it is active. And it has actually to make its way, well, it can even make its way to three dimensions, or sometimes it will be bound to the DNA in some unaffected place that has to walk along the DNA, and it is in fact subject to some kind of random energy landscape to which it has to diffuse. And the shape of this has a non-trivial impact on how rapidly the transcription factor can diffuse along the DNA. And there's some interesting work on precisely that problem which suggests that things are not as simple or as nice as you might like, and it may very well be that if you've gotten enough specificity to bind, you know, strongly bind when you want to start to bind, you may pay a price in finding that the speed of diffusion along the DNA in this random energy landscape is too slow for the transcription factor to find its target in the kind of time that will let you know. So, so there's an interesting physics problem right there.
Is it similar to that with these localizations?
Yeah, well, also random. These things, it's one dimension, so they don't work. I'm sorry, Henderson localization does have to be one. This is just random walk at the kind of energy. Okay, so let me blow up. So I can leave that little aside. Let me blow up the extreme tail of the distribution to open up the stuff issue. So here is the place that I'm, here's the part of the spectrum that disappeared below the resolution of the plot. The green arrows are the energies of the three sites that are known to be functioning. Okay, so here's the main one, and here are a couple of others. The red stuff is just a histogram of things from somewhere else in the genome, presumably not functional, but according to my model, energetically competitive. Okay, so at least the strongest bound site really is the strongest bound site. It's pretty amazing that comes out so nicely from so little input data. That's right. And the other point is that these other two sites, which are in fact quite significant for important function, but less strongly bound, They are interfered with by something like, you know, 10 or 12, I don't have a scale, or something, you can't tell. This turns out that this little collection sort of ordered 10 sites that are competitive with these sites. Now, why would that bother you? Well, it bothers you in this case because if you look at how many copies of this transcription factor molecule are actually present in the cell, the answer is just 50, order 10. And therefore, if you have competition on this level between these two sites, 10 sites in the genome, well, you know, these guys are simply not going to be occupied. So there's potentially a problem. Now, you really have to understand the dynamics of this whole system much better. We have not talked about the dynamics to know what this really is about. But let me just raise a general issue. Namely, I had a way of choosing the best energy function, which was to extremize a certain probability, a certain type of thing. But I did it approximately. I did it in the background of a random genome. Well, it isn't a bad machine. It's only 4.5 billion base pairs of E. coli, most distinctly not random. Why don't I just do my maximum likelihood optimization against the actual machine and see what I get? Do I get something significant? So you have to do that by computer, but it's not hard to do. So the exercise is sort of interesting because what happens in this particular case is that the three sites that are functional finally separate themselves from the rest of the genome. And there was a modest difference in any one of those entries in the matrix that was described at both points, but the effect of small changes in these numbers on the extreme statistics is large. At least goes in the right direction. So, this is encouraging. What's slightly discouraging is if you go through the same line of argument for this other transcription factor, dozens and dozens of binding sites, you find that, first of all, the problem is much more severe. The things that are known to be functional, really deeply intertwined with sort of a fairly fat tail of the rest of the genome. And even if I go for the exercise of trying to do the optimization more accurately for each of the real genome, not a heck of a lot of changes. So, does that mean that this simple model, the energy, has failed? If so, we're sort of up a creek, because the whole point of working for this, for me at any rate, was to get confidence in a simple model of how does the transcription factor find its target, so that I can start thinking about, okay, how difficult is it really to put together a whole control network? How difficult is it to get two different transcription factors doing independent things? How can I avoid crosstalk and all the rest of that? I can only know that that's possible if I have some kind of description, quantitative nature, of this sequence of kind of energy. So this actually was interesting because, you know, it looks like one has failed. It's demonstrated that there exist transcription factors which are all from this work. And that would be very unpleasant for trying to go to the next level of understanding. Biologists would be at all concerned, but theorists who want to try to get some kind of modeling understanding of what's going on is disturbed. So there is one possible outcome, and that is that you should make a large fraction of these red sites blue. I did not choose red and blue for political animus in mind, but I would like to think about converting red states to blue states. And so the question is, we had a vote here, is this been a legitimate vote? Or has there been fiddling in the ballot box? Is it possible that these people really voted blue and I just don't know? That would be nice. If so, if I could give you something, concluding that as a matter of fact, my ingoing list of binding sites is simply incomplete. That there are lots of places where this transcription factor is active, but I do not have direct evidence for that. Then maybe my attitude towards this model would change. Now, there's one tiny bit of evidence that I haven't made much of so far, and that is that all of these sites in here that are a large, up to a fairly substantial number of such competing sites, these red guys are not just genome here. They're sitting in not random locations in the genome, but they're sitting in the so-called non-coded regions between genes, exactly where control sequences should lie, highly non-random as to location. So that's one piece of evidence that these things maybe aren't so good after all. If you want to look at this more deeply, well, you could the things that are in these piles are specific sites, specific locations, and you can run it through an experiment. However, that's not something I was prepared to do. So, as my final element of this discussion, let me bring in some notions from evolution. Okay, so you have a problem. You have a bunch of predicted binding sites for this particular transcription factor. But it's predicted in the sense that they have energies which are competitive with binding energies of things. They can only be functional. But you have no direct evidence that they really are functional. And you might deduce the fact that though they're not just randomly located in the genome, they're in particularly sensible places which really were functional. What can you do short of actually doing experiments? Okay, so at this point I got my first dabbling in the sea of evolution. So there's a line of argument that you can go down, which turns out to be sort of interesting. Suppose that the spherical sites were indeed functional. If that's the case, then you ought to be able to perform the following exercise. Take E. coli and take some organism which is very closely related to it. Okay, so E. coli has a number of other gut bacteria that are like it. There are some of them are sequenced. One of those sequenced, which is worth looking at, is Salmonella. A nice thing to have in your gut, I suppose, but almost very, very similar to E. coli. Its genome organization is almost the same. It has almost the same genes. Some genes are missing, some genes are mushed around, but there's a high similarity in the organization of the genomes and in the genes themselves. Okay, I don't care about genes, I'm talking about these control sequences. Well, if I can find, so take these, if I can find the evolutionary orthol, the thing that is related to it, a control sequence in E. coli, compare it to the corresponding sequence in Salmonella, sort of line them up and ask, are they the same? Well, no, they won't be exactly the same. Are there mutations? Are there base pair differences here and there? In general, yes. If these two sites, in two different organisms, are non-functional, if I just pick them out by mistake, then the mutations ought to be just coming real quick. Should be a spatial pattern for their occurrence. Whereas, if you think about it, if they are in fact functional, then there ought to be a spatial pattern in the occurrence of mutations, because there are some places, as we saw, within that site where it costs a lot of, there's a strong tendency to have a particular base pair. It costs a lot of energy not to have a C in position 5, let's say. So, that would mean the likelihood of a mutation occurring in that position should be low if, in fact, that site is functional. So that's the general idea. So here's the strategy. Take these two closely related organisms. Find all possible orthologous cryogenic regions. That is okay, means the bottom. Orthologous gene. Here's a particular gene, okay, in E. coli. I'll find the gene in Salmonella that is the most likely by some standard procedure. It will all, typically will be very, very much like it indeed. That's an orthologous gene. It's clearly the relative cousin. So Therefore, I can easily find orthologous for the related object and related organisms. I can find the orthologous genes. Now, let's find regions between genes for which the genes on either side, in both cases, are the same gene. I mean, they're not exactly the same, but clearly they're orthologous. So this is visible in these tables because they give the genes names. So black CRP and E. coli and CRP and Salmonella. Well, they're given the same name for the reason that those two guys can actually clear. So find orthologous intergenic regions. And then align those orthologous intergenic regions. Alignment, I'll show you an example in just a second, it simply means find the way for shifting the frame so that you get the smallest number of mutations and the smallest number of gaps and so on. And then you can tell who got to who by mutation. Right? And then in E. coli, you have one of these putative binding sites, and next to it, in Salmonella, there is a guy that's, to which he aligns. You call that the putative binding site that corresponds to him in Salmonella. Now you have something that you can perform some mutation analysis. So let's go, so some data. So out of the 3,500 intergenic regions, something like half of them are involved in the same gene names on either side. By the way, the mean mutation rate in the stretches of DNA between genes is about 25%. So one base pair in four is changed. That's quite a lot. Even those of these are very, very biological. And we're talking about stretches of DNA that are 20-ish base pairs long. So you know, on average, you would have like five, six mutations quite easily. Okay, and E. coli sites are selected using the predictive energies. The Salmonella sites are generated by alignment. And now you can say, okay, put various cutoffs and filters on these E. coli sites. Ask, what does the position dependence of the mutation probability on these sites look like? So here's an example of alignment. So there are two genes, FC and Folinic. Who doesn't know what they are? But in any case, they do something, one of them does something with folic acid, I'm sure. So they're next to each other in both genomes. And you know, here is the precise sequence between these two genes in E. coli. Here is the precise sequence between those two genes in Salmonella. I've used one of the standard alignment programs to bring them to match them as closely as we possibly can. And I've indicated here, here's one of these binding sites that I'm concerned about. Okay. And here's the aligned sequence. Sorry, here's one of them. This is the E. coli binding site, and this is the aligned sequence. And you can see that, well, in many places the two base pairs are the same, in some places they're not, and there's some pattern of mutations. You have some mutations here, you know, here, 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 and there. Now, if you were to try to find binding sites, by saying, let's just look at places where the mutations are suppressed because you know, they'll screw around with something, a good thing, got this thing working, they're going to lose function by having mutations. You would never pick out this region. So it's measured by our knowledge of the energy. And let's see. There are various other things we could do here, but this is the procedure. We're going to find a population of pairs like this. And we're going to get statistics on where within the strain mutations occur together. And what you see is this. So depending on where you put the cutoff, I'll take all the sites that meet all of these criteria, this region cutoff less than so and so high, I'll take all of the orthologous pairs of sites, and I will use them to construct the probability of mutation. So here's a strong cutoff, E less than 5. There's only 9 sites that meet that cutoff of orthologous partners and all the rest of that. And so there's certainly bound to be some the statistical noise in the red curve, but you see something interesting. Noise and no noise, basically, the mutations are suppressed here, and the high, little high on the X. Raise the energy cutoff, get an order of 100 cycles. You see a slightly less pronounced pattern, but it's the same that pattern. And there's a symmetry between the two sides, and there's a region, middle region, where the mutations are highly suppressed. And when you go to a large energy cutoff and a lot of sites, you get something which is more or less a distinguishing event there. So this is what you should see if the sites that you're picking out have no function. There's no reason for the mutations to have any kind of spatial pattern. If they do have function, and that function has to do with a particular structure of the protein, it's like DNA, then you would indeed expect a spatial pattern. And you see, this pattern goes away if you increase the energy cutoff to a certain point. So it rather strongly suggests that your energy function, even though it's picking up lots more sites than you put in, is actually picking up sites that must, according to the evidence of evolution, have a function. It doesn't tell you what that function is, but it tells you what it means. Okay. Roughly speaking, what's going on is that what's conserved is the overall binding region, not the specific sequence. This makes a lot of sense. In other words, in the places where any change in the base causes a big change in the binding energy, you're unlikely to get a mutation. In places where it's indifferent, like this or that, then you can indeed have a mutation. And there's a nice correlation between the energy cost, the energy contribution of a particular site, and that mutation profile. Okay, so the position of mutation profile is a strong function of the binding energy, and it suggests that this binding energy function we've been talking about is a pretty nice surrogate for the real thing, and that gives us some justification for continuing on this general line of trying to understand what the sequence of the binding energy is, and then using models for that to examine the construction of genetic metrics. So this is just to say, you can carry out the same exercise for other transcription factors and for other genomes, and there's an interesting story there which I will, I think, have to say for another minute. Okay, so I really got through half of what I wanted to talk about, but I knew that would happen. I'll have to read fluctuations, noise, genetic switch stability, and using information theory as a way of getting coordinate-free descriptions of what's significant in expression analysis, expression of data analysis during the time. I guess the general point I wanted to make is that there is a quality and type of data about cellular things that happen in the cell that has become available in biology, which makes it possible to start thinking in a rather detailed way about mathematically describing the function of these cells. It's not going to be mathematics of the type that we are familiar with as theoretical physicists. You have to do it. But the problems are problems that require delays, the kind of thing you're familiar with. And there's just so many different areas in which bringing the attitude of the theoretical physicist will shed new light on the whole problem. But it's a very worthy enterprise, and one that I think is going to prosper in the future. Whether we will ever get any kind of deep theoretical understanding of why a cell does what it does, how does evolution, things like that, on the scale of sophistication, comprehensiveness of, say, our understanding of quantum mechanics. We know everything we need to know in principle about how atoms work, details. Here, the nature of the underlying theory is not all clear. On the other hand, there's so much good data, and so many good questions that can be asked that I think it's safe to say that interesting problems will be around in this area years and years to come, and there is opportunity for people to think about theoretical physicists to do interesting work. The time has yet to come. This kind of work, this kind of stuff, that really knocks the socks off the biologists and those are the things that they don't really know, you know, that they really care about. But it's my conviction that that's just a matter of time. So I'll stop there. How long speakers should last, and those are his self. But I'm sure it's his mouth.
Can you try to use a large scale simulation of
yes. I mean, the problem with that, I mean, so what I knew about the process of evolution is that the organisms have a genome, and the genome carries the information that gets passed on. And the connection between genome and fitness, and basically what happens is that so some organisms, the one who's developed, has some change in the genome which causes it to be more efficient growing or whatever than anybody else. So what's always missing in these sort of mass simulations is not you